Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the case for corporate breakups. We'll spend this hour with Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu, talking about why federal antitrust cases have become so rare in recent decades, leaving huge companies like Facebook, Google, and Amazon big enough to eliminate any serious competitors by acquiring them. The traditional argument against companies with enormous market share is that they drive up consumer prices. When companies offer their products for free, Wu says there is still a huge potential consequence. Lack of competition tends to stifle innovation. Our conversation starts after a short break. This week I was trying to track down a package I sent my son. He's away at school. And I discovered that with a couple of clicks, you can look up all your previous orders on Amazon. So 10 years ago, in 2008, I ordered 6 things. To date this year, I'm at 120 items and counting. It's not that I'm buying more stuff overall. I'm just buying a lot more from this one company now. Groceries, housewares, hardware, clothing. And I know I'm not alone. So do you ever stand back and think about just how big companies like Amazon and Google and Facebook have become, how integrated into our lives? Should we worry about how much control these mega corporations have over what we see, what we buy, and what we pay? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Tim Wu is a policy advocate professor at Columbia Law School and contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. In his new book, The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age, Wu urges readers to consider the costs to consumers, to competition, and to innovation of an economy that lets a few gigantic firms dominate and eliminate competitors not by outperforming them, but by absorbing them. He joins us from NPR in New York to talk about what's got him concerned. Tim, welcome to Think.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
So this term, the curse of bigness, was coined by Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis. What was he referring to?
You know, he was referring to the growth of corporations in his time into these giant trusts like the Standard Oil Company and U.S. Steel. And he suggested that, you know, in reaction, the people at the time were saying, well, you know, these are the greatest marvels of the modern age and they're efficient. And he said, actually, a lot of these really big corporations are at some level a curse. You know, they're efficient for a few years, but then often they become inefficient. But more profoundly, they are threatening to democracy. They bribe government. And they are a threat to some of the freedoms that Americans cherish, you know, the sort of freedoms that we'd always thought were ours. And so he thought, overall, we had become seduced by bigness and needed to think anew about our origins as a country.
Let's talk about that threat to democracy that Brandeis worried about. You remind us here that corporations have a great deal of power and influence. Of course, nobody elects them. How, though, would a monopoly be hazardous to democracy?
Well, I think one thing that political scientists have come to understand is that, surprise, surprise, Congress and legislatures don't always do what voters want them to do, that they're susceptible to influence. And one of the questions is, well, you know, who has the influence? You know, the number of groups. But generally speaking, the more concentrated an industry is, the easier it is for them to cooperate to achieve their desired outcomes. So, for example, the pharmaceutical industry has been very effective in lobbying collectively for provisions like non-negotiation of rates for pharmaceuticals by Medicaid. And so, you know, that costs them $100 million maybe, but saves them or costs us $15 billion a year, and they get that in revenue. So I guess what I'm trying to suggest is that the more concentrated, the more monopolistic our industries are, the further government drifts away from what the people want.
There have always been people who were, for lack of a better term, pro-trust, pro-monopoly. Besides the people who were directly profiting from that, what sort of individuals figured it was fine to let corporations get as big as they could?
You know, I think there's an age-old seduction, a seductive power to bigness, to grandeur, to greatness. In the 19th century, companies like Standard Oil, their backers, suggested that the American economy was evolving, leaving behind Adam Smith's competition, the way man had evolved from the ape, that, you know, this idea, the founding idea of competition and lots of businesses trying to outdo each other was outdated. It was more scientific to have sort of an Uber company who just did what was right. And I think we sometimes see some of that reflected today. Peter Thiel, a prominent backer of Facebook, for instance, says that competition is for losers, that monopoly is a transcendent form, and you know, if you trust these guys, they'll do what's right. And so I think there's a real allure to it, but I think it's one we need to resist.
So you say that corporations can actually stop innovating as they get too big and bloated. How does that happen exactly? It would seem that they still want to keep growing, and therefore they would continue working as hard as they possibly could.
Yeah, it's really a point that a Nobel Prize-winning economist, Kenneth Arrow, made, which is that once you have achieved a monopoly, that your reasons to keep improving tend to disappear. You know, maybe you can think of it this way. If you're in a race and there's a whole bunch of other runners, you might feel you need to run faster. If it's just you, you can kind of just start walking. And once you've managed to destroy your competitors, you can kind of just start ambling along. There's no real reason to need to improve. Microsoft has had a monopoly over operating systems, and particularly over products like Word for quite some time, and they haven't really faced a sharp pressure to improve. And I think you see that sort of across the economy. I'll just leave it there.
Why wouldn't companies recognize that as a risk for themselves?
Well, what's the risk? If you have a well-defended monopoly, what other than, maybe meeting some marginal demands, if you don't have anyone possibly threatening to replace you, why would you invest the efforts into real improvements? You don't need to. It's sort of like imagine the only hotel in a small town. Why would you upgrade the hotel? I mean, you might, you know, maybe want rats running around, but hey, if it's cheaper, why not? People don't have a choice.
Yeah.
Why would you invest in improvements?
All right. So
it's only rational, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. It's from their perspective, it's like they've reached the sweet spot where they don't have to try so hard.
Yeah. And it's not like I think no company would ever say this publicly. And, you know, a company like AT&T, which was long the telephone monopolist, is a good illustration of this problem. You know, from the 50s onwards, they'd sort of figured out how the telephone system was going to be. And their improvements were pretty small, you know, three-way calling or call waiting. They didn't think the answering machine was appropriate. They were opposed to speaker phones other than for business. So for a whole bunch of reasons, they thought the internet was never going to work. So, you know, for a bunch of reasons, they never really felt the need to innovate, mainly because, well, what are we going to do, not use the telephone? So
you describe in this book a number of boom and bust cycles of vigorous antitrust action. First of all, how did the first monopolies come into existence in the United States?
Yeah, so they were largely the product of massive consolidation campaigns. If you think of U.S. Steel as the still existing steel monopolist, J.P. Morgan, you know, sort of famous figure with the top hat and the big nose, did these deals where he would take an industry like steel, which had something like 130 members, and say, listen, let's just stop competing, sign a giant peace treaty, and just be one giant firm and split the proceeds. And everybody will get rich, and this is, you know, the way of the future. Come, let's join together. In fact, yeah, I think he sort of saw himself as this enlightened figure who was, brokering peace agreements among warring companies. And so that's how the first, and, you know, over the period of about 1880 through 1900, almost every American industry became a trust. There was a tobacco trust, cotton trust for nails, steel, you know, you name it. They were all combined into this new form of business. And that created the trust of which the antitrust law was a reaction to.
So Teddy Roosevelt turned out to be a vigorous champion of the Sherman Antitrust Act. What approach had William McKinley, Roosevelt's predecessor, taken to managing monopolies?
Yeah, so the formations of the trust engendered a lot of opposition. You know, among other things, their labor practices weren't particularly generous. They back then, when there was a strike, they would, you know, hire a militia to shoot the workers. So it's a little more intense, even a little more intense than today. And there was a backlash. The farmers were angry. Actually, not unlike our times in some ways. There were a lot of people who felt that the economy was not serving the broad middle of the country, that it was leaving a huge number of people behind. It was even more stark than our times because, you know, the salaries for workers were so low and putting, you know, so many people out of business. So it was this huge reaction and the passage of an antitrust law by Congress. But McKinley, who you mentioned, took the view fundamentally that business, in a sense, had its own sovereignty, that the Sherman Act antitrust laws were symbolic, but that it was let well enough alone, laissez-faire. You really shouldn't meddle with anything to do with business. And that was the governing ideology of the Republican Party just until Theodore Roosevelt succeeded after the assassination of McKinley.
So how did the Sherman Act come into existence?
Well, you know, it's something that people have debated at enormous length. And I think ultimately there was such public anger about the trust, such a sense that they were unfair and dangerous. And contrary to some of the founding ideas of the American Republic, which had been, after all, an anti-monopoly movement, the Boston Tea Party was against the tea monopoly, that it a coalition of farmers, workers, people who are concerned about other issues, all got together. Both Republican and Democratic parties got into this. John Sherman was a Republican who, the act bears his name, who sponsored the bill. And the debate, however, is whether they really meant it or whether it was symbolic. And people like McKinley said, well, you know, it was really just a way to appease people and, you know, say we don't approve of big business going too far, but it wasn't ever really meant to be enforced. But as you've already alluded to, Theodore Roosevelt took a profoundly different view.
Well, these days, if you ask, you know, John or Jane Q. Public, people are just about as likely to say that they don't trust the government as to say that the big corporations are doing things that are unfair. Is it fair? Is it going too far to say that markets now sort of outrank government in the United States?
I think that is a widespread idea. I think that Americans believe in freedom very powerfully and treasure their autonomy. And I think some of that is reflected actually in something I agree with, which is hostility to excessive control of our lives by government. One thing I think it's missing sometimes that we forget is how much private parties can also constrain us. I don't know if you ever waited on hold to deal with your insurance company or, you know, or been pulled out of an airline or, you know, any number of ways in which dealt with your cable company, whatever ways in which life can be made very difficult by private parties. But I think we should fear big government and big business.
So what did Roosevelt see as his justification for unleashing the Sherman Act against the robber barons of his day? Like, did he have an uphill political hill to climb in order to do this?
Yeah, well, he is a profoundly courageous fellow because anyone else would have said it's political suicide to go to war with the most powerful companies on earth, the greatest backers of the Republican Party. And I wasn't even elected. I just was the vice president. I mean, elected as vice president, but, you know, here I am. But he had, I think, very, there's a reason he is who he is. He said in letters that if the government did not act to reflect the will of the people, that we would face a socialist or anarchist revolution. So he was, frankly, concerned with democracy and preserving it.
Tim Wu is a professor at Columbia Law School and contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. We're talking about his new book, The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find us on Twitter. We're at @KERAThink. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with law professor, policy advocate, and New York Times contributing opinion writer Tim Wu about his new book, The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Okay, Tim, how did the American market landscape change after the Roosevelt administration wielded the power that it had to bring antitrust action against monopolies?
You know, I think it was changed in a very profound way. Most of the trusts were either broken into constituent parts or placed under some kind of regulatory regime. So there was not a complete reversal, but a reversal in the tendency which had called for the control of the American economy by one monopolist per sector. That was broken for good.
All right, I want to talk about Robert Bork, somebody whose name is maybe familiar to listeners of a certain age, mostly because he failed to be confirmed as a Supreme Court justice. He is hugely influential in the world of antitrust law, and I imagine quite a hero to enormous companies everywhere. How did he form his opinions about how to interpret antitrust statutes?
So, yeah, Robert Bork is a pivotal figure in the 20th century economic history in a way people may not realize who just think about him and the Supreme Court. In some ways, I think his influence exceeds many of the justices who he didn't join. So he, in the 1950s, was—actually, he in his early days was a self-professed socialist helped those youths through college. Then he said he sort of became a New Deal liberal. But then in the 50s, he went to the University of Chicago, took an antitrust class with a mysterious figure named Aaron Director, and said he underwent almost a religious conversion. Now he'd seen the light, and he believed everything should be subject to the most severe economic principles. And as time changed, he became very different in what he thought the antitrust law should do. He believed that it existed only for one purpose, that it was only to essentially protect consumers from being overcharged by monopolies, and any other purpose, sort of political or related to the size of companies, that those were invalid ideas and shouldn't be respected. Now, he purported to say to demonstrate that Congress had thought that. Nobody since that time has agreed that Bork was correct or even honest about how he read the congressional history. But his ideas, nonetheless, have had an enormous and lasting influence.
What you call things is always so influential in how they're perceived. And Bork's way of thinking is referred to as the consumer welfare standard, which I have to say sounds benevolent. If somebody said your lawmakers are going to adhere to the consumer welfare standard in interpreting antitrust law, I would think that sounds pretty good.
Yes, I have to admit. Yes, I agree. Robert Bork, first of all, a genius in terms of his thinking. Second of all, an amazing advocate, both as a lawyer, but also in some ways as a policy marketing person. He did coin this phrase, consumer welfare, which appealed, for example, to Ralph Nader, who started saying, yeah, that's really the ticket. And it does sound appealing. Who could possibly disagree with the idea of welfare for consumers? But what it did, especially over the long term, was limit what the antitrust law did to basically two categories. One was, cartels for price fixing, which everyone agrees were illegal, and the second was absolute mergers to monopoly. But beyond that, almost everything else was free. And if you explore the consequences of the Bork view, it really does return us to that late 19th century laissez-faire view where almost nothing ends up being a violation of the antitrust laws.
So by the consumer welfare standard, if I'm understanding this correctly, a company like Google or like Facebook, which have enormous impact on Americans' daily lives, they're not susceptible to breakup because they don't charge individual users for their services. Am I oversimplifying that too much?
I think you're essentially correct. Now, there are, these are lawyers and complicated matters, and there's more than one way to understand consumer welfare. But I would say that the requirement that you prove a price harm to consumers makes it very hard to do something like, let's say, break up Facebook if you think they have too much power. Because, well, how would you prove that Facebook has increased prices for consumers? They don't even charge consumers. They make the money from advertisers. So it certainly has muddied matters and I believe has contributed greatly to the rise of concentration in the tech industry, as you mentioned, with Amazon and Facebook, but also just across the U.S. economy, that this Borky and Chicago view of things has, for example, led us to have three major airlines, has led cable basically to have a sort of monopoly in the cable business and many other things which I regard as highly undesirable.
Here's a giant irony. You trace the rise of kind of second wave internet giants to an earlier antitrust action against Microsoft.
Yeah, that's true. So the last sort of era in which the antitrust laws were enforced very vigorously was in the 90s, and Microsoft was the target. And the amazing thing about, the interesting thing about that action is how much effect it had ultimately in helping out today's giants. Microsoft was a very cunning company. Bill Gates had this talent for seeing the future and trying to control it. This is before Bill Gates became this kind of kindly philanthropist. He was the evil nerd in the 90s, big glasses and everything. And what he wanted to do was control the browser and from that control all subsequent development of what happened on the web. And so in a different alternative future where there hadn't been any scrutiny of Microsoft, I think you would have clearly seen Bing given the advantage over Google. Whatever Facebook came up with might have beaten up Amazon. Not Facebook, whatever Amazon, I'm sorry, Microsoft was able to sponsor beating out Amazon maybe, and maybe some Microsoft version of the cell phone breaking Apple's iPhone. So you have a completely different future where everything has an M on it. And I think today's giants really do owe a giant debt of loyalty to the Justice Department. Or just, not loyalty, a debt of gratitude to the Justice Department.
All right, let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Mark calling from Houston. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thanks.
I've got a question about, you know, it's mostly about the online retailers. In the past, you'd have an online retailer would purchase another one just to expand their client base. However, you've got a company like Amazon that has such a huge client base at this point that there's really no need to buy another online company. They can go into any market, sell drugs or sell shoes or sell whatever, and with their client base, they can put prevent others from going into that market, and they can just put everybody out of business.
Thanks for calling. What about that, Tim?
I think it's a great point. What should have been the lesson of the Standard Oil period is that we shouldn't allow companies to simply buy up their competitors. However, I hate to say it, but over the last 10 years, it's almost been open season for Facebook, for Amazon, for Google to buy up their entire industries and kind of reconstruct, create trusts like Standard Oil. You know, Facebook, I think at this point, has 71 unchallenged transactions. So they bought 71 companies. Not a single one was blocked or even conditioned. Amazon is more, something I think over 100, and Google's the grand champion with over 200. Some of these were very small acquisitions, but some of them were serious competitors. You know, Facebook was facing a real threat from Instagram, for instance, and as opposed to fighting it out, they just bought them. And that's, I think, the opposite of what the competitive system and also our system of innovation is supposed to call for. You can't just buy your way out of a competitive problem, but we have let it happen.
We have an email here from Diane who wants to know if you'll talk about Amazon's search for an HQ2 city being an exercise in Amazon's monopoly power.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to talk about that. I'd regard it more as an example of the influence over government of excessively large companies. You know, a whole Amazon is just one company, but they're a very concentrated company. And so when they announce they're going to open a new headquarters, they're able to convince governments to offer billions of dollars. I think New Jersey was going to offer $8 billion or something like that, for Amazon to come there. And it just strikes me as upside down in a sense. You pay one of the most valuable corporations, you pay them more in order to do business there. You know, compare them with, like, let's say 1,000 small businesses that move to an area or might or not. They never get any subsidies. And so, you know, it's a zero-sum game competition. And if you subsidize Amazon, you're basically penalizing everybody else. And so I take it as evidence of another way you're able to tilt the playing field in favor of the big guys.
It is pretty brilliant if you think about it. Even forcing cities to compete with one another, it seems like it has to make them want it more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know, there are good things about states competing. You know, you can try out different systems and see what works. But, you know, bending over backwards to try to find ways to subsidize an incredibly successful company, you know, does seem to turn the whole idea of a representative democracy on its head.
You said that it's been about 20 years or more since there has been really major antitrust activity in this country. What kinds of conditions do judges consider now when they decide whether or not to approve proposed corporate mergers?
Well, you know, we looked at this recently, and I'm afraid that the influence of Bork and the Chicago School and a sort of very limited view of antitrust, almost nihilistic, has become prevalent. So recently, as some of your listeners may know, AT&T was buying Time Warner, or wanted to buy Time Warner, and despite the Justice Department pointing out this would be anti-competitive and would raise prices for everyone, and if any listeners are Dish subscribers, they know they have already blacked out HBO for Dish, which competes with AT&T. Nonetheless, the judge, first of all, demanded and insisted on seeing price effects. And then when the economist presented them, a very, very accomplished economist, he just sort of disagreed with the economists and wanted just such levels of proof that basically nothing will stop it. I just say this to point out the federal judiciary has actually become in some ways the heart of the problem to reactivating antitrust. They demand so much standards, such burdens of proof, that it's unclear, at this point at least, what kind of cases would win. And it's a little bit of a distressing thing for those who believe that antitrust has long been the heart and soul of this country's economic policy.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. All right, back to the phones now. We have David on the line in San Antonio. Hi, David.
Hello. Yes, my question is about internet service. You're just touching on cable companies there. We have two choices here. Google Fiber is supposedly coming, but we have AT&T or Spectrum. And what if I need just some basic internet service? AT&T offers 50 megabits for $40 a month, Spectrum 200 for about the same price. I don't know, depending upon for a certain amount of time, then it goes up. But AT&T has a data cap, and in order to get that price, you also have to have another a qualifying AT&T service, in quotes, that kind of thing. Whereas in Mexico, my nephew gets, in rural Mexico, a landline with unlimited calling to the U.S. plus 10 megabit internet DSL for $18 a month U.S. roughly.
Wow.
How can we rein in internet prices?
Thanks for calling.
That's a great point. In fact, I spent many years of my career trying to deal with exactly that issue. Obviously, wasn't as successful as I should have been. Americans greatly overpay for broadband. We have some of the highest prices in the world. It's one of the ways in which I think the fate of ordinary Americans has sort of suffered during our time, in the sense that along with wages not going up, when the price of the basics go up, it is almost like a cut in salaries. And, you know, I think it's a serious problem. You know, if you're inside the industry, and I was inside the industry, you know that services are extremely cheap to provide. You know, they almost cost nothing, maybe a couple dollars. And you can charge $40 or $60 a month for them. So it's one of the most profitable lines of business anywhere. And competition, such as it is, has completely failed to reduce prices in this area. I'm actually surprised more local governments, more state governments, aren't trying to use their powers to regulate those rates because, you know, at some point, they're almost like the electric company in sense of providing something that everyone needs. But unlike the electric company, they can charge whatever they want. And any effort to sort of control this through competition has failed.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the phone, we go to Austin, where Roger is calling. Hi, Roger.
Hi. Excellent discussion. And I guess I'm just going to be like most everyone else and gravitate towards technology. So I'm very enamored with the Internet of Things. And you're going to have all these devices that are spewing off all this data. And all that data all of a sudden is in the hands of companies who are driven by a profit motive. And I'm wondering about the, has anyone considered like data ownership? And I don't have a problem with government because theoretically I feel like I can vote a government out. But my ability to sort of put that control on a company is limited, and when all these Internet of Things are going to give such a rich, detailed information on me, it really scares me.
Roger, that's a really interesting question. We're about to go to break, so I'm going to have Tim hold off on giving you a response to that, but we will get to it in just a moment. My guest is Tim Wu. He's a professor at Columbia Law School, and he writes opinion columns for the New York Times. His new book is called The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. We'll come back to the conversation in 2 minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org. You can find us on Twitter @KERAThink or get on the phone. The number is 1-800-933-5372. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with policy advocate and Columbia Law professor Tim Wu, author of The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. Our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. That's where we heard from Roger, Tim, just before the break, who wanted to know about data ownership in this era of the Internet of Things.
Sure, thanks. I thought he made a very profound point, actually, as well, which I'd like to highlight, about the relative accountability of government and business. There's sort of this idea out here that, you know, government is so dangerous, and they do have the monopoly on force, but at least they have some mechanisms of accountability, voting, the judiciary, and so forth. Business, well, you can say, well, I won't do business with them, but sometimes you don't really have a choice. You know, another caller was talking about broadband. You know, you're just going to go without the internet, electricity, you're going to go without electricity. Unless you're willing to be a complete hermit living somewhere in the Texas desert, you know, sometimes you just sort of have to deal with these parties, and I think that's important. As for data, you know, I'm fundamentally concerned about power and unaccountable power, and, you know, that's sort of my thing, and that's what I think about. And one thing that happens over history is the source of power may change. The asset or the resource which conveys power might change. You know, if one day it was control of, you know, metal, another time it might be something else. And, you know, in the 20th century, radio spectrum started becoming a source of power. If you look at, you know, the rise of the Third Reich or the propaganda campaigns of the Soviet Union, you see that total control of the airwaves became very important. And in our time, data has this kind of power that people haven't fully come to understand or grapple with. We know it means something. We don't know how much. And I just think our underlying mandate should be, in a land that wants to be free, to control all unaccountable forms of power. that's why I think, you know, taking data and its power seriously is very important to what it will mean to be free in this century.
So there's a story just today in the New York Times about the rise of Facebook and the kind of obsessive focus on growth of Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg. What might a breakup of a company like Facebook even look like?
Oh, I think that's straightforward in my thinking. So over the 2010s, they completed a series of what were now clearly illegal mergers. I mentioned them earlier, I think, the buying of Instagram, which was at one point one of their greatest threats, WhatsApp, their greatest global competitor. They bought them. They got this through the merger review process without even a serious challenge. And I think what you do is you just retroactively break off those firms, dissolve the trust, a little bit like what Teddy Roosevelt did in his day. And I don't think it would solve every problem facing this country, but it would send an important message, one that Roosevelt himself thought was very important, to suggest who really rules this country. You know, is this a democracy or not? One of the things that New York Times expose highlighted, which I think was really important, is the degree to which Facebook has built an immunity to government regulation and has studied all the arts of Washington influence so that, when a scandal breaks, that they have, very powerful members of Congress defending them. The advice of former White House counsel, former Supreme Court judges, some of them I know, Supreme Court lawyers and clerks and so forth, who really understand how you immunize a firm from effective oversight or regulation. So I think the only way government gets serious about this is starting to break these companies into smaller pieces.
And you could do that under the Clayton Act?
It would be a very good call, yes. Retrospective merger enforcement under Section 7 of the Clayton Act for those who follow the law's details.
All right, back to the phones now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go this time to Chris in Tyler. Hi, Chris.
Hey, hello. Professor, you mentioned earlier about municipalities or electric co-ops using their abilities to create broadband networks, but it's actually illegal in the state of Texas since 2005 for either a municipality or an electric co-op to offer telecommunications services, along with 16 other states. However, several years ago, I believe that several cities, municipalities in the state of Colorado, where these barriers also exist, had ballot initiatives to essentially ignore state law, and the voters urged their municipalities to create such broadband networks. Chattanooga, Tennessee comes to mind with their electric co-op provider offering a fiber product that is essentially the same model that Google Fiber used and is price competitive to that in Chattanooga, Tennessee. And so what can those of us who work in the telecom industry, and I'm a network engineer and I help rural co-ops develop line-of-sight fixed wireless solutions for rural and difficult terrain areas and those types of things. And so what can we do in our state, at least, to remove these barriers that exist to actually, like you said, allow municipalities and electric co-ops who already have lots of pole infrastructure, they've got miles and miles of electrical cable,
right,
that they maintain. Yeah. How do we help ourselves move forward?
Thank you so much for your call, Chris.
Yeah, no, I think he's stated the case pretty strongly already, so he's helped by making it clear. Yeah, the laws need to be repealed, obviously. They're absurd laws that ban cities from helping their citizens save money by providing them with internet access, often at a fraction of the price, or at least provide some competition to the major telephone companies. And the passage of laws in those states is something of a standing scandal that nonetheless it never gets rectified. The only answer is voting for people who are not able to be corrupted by the local telecom monopolist, which is a challenging proposition, but I think you need a breed of politician who really does and credibly is independent from the influence of the major monopolists. Also, if, as I said earlier, if we start to break the power of monopolists, politicians are less likely to do what they say.
Can any of this realistically change in a Citizens United reality where corporations are granted the right to speech like people?
Citizens United is one challenge. I don't see that actually as the greatest, even though I oppose that for other reasons. I think the Bill of Rights was intended for humans, and I'll just leave it at that. I think the great challenge is judicial hostility to anything that resembles economic regulation, even though it's so important, you know, in a country where we believe the people rule, that you be able to experiment with things like, as we just talked about, what about some towns, providing internet access. There's such hostility to it. I think it requires not only different kind of politician, but judges, who are more effectively pushed on what their views are on economic matters. In the Republican Party, this gets into party politics, but I don't think the Democratic Party in particular has had much of an emphasis on economic issues, and I think that's creating part of the problem.
All right, back to the phones now. We'll speak with Don in Dallas. Hey, Don.
Hello. Just wanted to ask if the antitrust issues being studied and discussed here, how they would relate, if they would relate to the soaring cost of medical care. I understand the need for extra funds for studies and development of new cures and medicines and things, but after living overseas for the better part of 25 years, where I did not enjoy at all their socialized medicine approaches there either, but the soaring cost here between doctors, hospitals, and pharmaceuticals, and therefore insurance as well, would your guests have any insights or suggestions?
What do you think, Tim?
I definitely do, and I'm glad you brought up healthcare, because as bad as tech may be, and it's obviously more visible day to day, I think the medical healthcare industry, pharmaceutical industry combined, may be among the worst in terms of its elevation of prices and sort of immunity to competition. There's been a number of things we've let happen that we should reverse. A good example is that hospitals have combined in this enormous. Hospitals have merged in many areas and cities, and so the studies of them show that when hospitals merge, the prices go up and their standards of care go down as measured by fatalities. In other words, more people die and at higher prices. The pharmaceutical industry has been getting away with all kinds of mischief for years, and not unlike Facebook, I think they've learned that all I have to do is sort of apologize every once in a while and just keep jacking the prices. You know, there was a lot of scandals around the raising of the price on Daraprim to this sort of obscure drug to $760 a pill from $2. It's still at that price. You know, nothing has changed. And there's this problem where Congress will kind of put on a show about being outraged, but they don't actually do anything. And when I was in government, I was trying to do something. I got foiled at every effort. The situation's out of control. I believe the antitrust law, reintroducing competition, breaking up some of the bigger companies, breaking some of the hospitals, can send an important message. But actually, frankly, the whole system is so broken that it really needs a more comprehensive effort than just antitrust law. But antitrust law is a big part.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Is there such a thing, Tim, as too big to trust bust? Could we get to the point where a breakup of a true monopoly becomes functionally impossible?
I do not think so. If we do, that's a very dangerous situation, for it suggests, you know, we've almost given a constitutional status to a company. And, I don't think that was part of the framing ideal, the founding ideals of this country. But, I could hear the point. Maybe everyone uses Amazon. Amazon is so convenient and, saves us money that we abandon all of retail to them. I think it's a very dangerous path to go down, because Amazon may be the most efficient company now, but once they're completely immunized from competition, they're already starting to raise the Prime memberships, if you haven't noticed, by much higher than inflation. And then in some ways, we're sort of subject to their arbitrary will. And I just think it's against the Constitution, against the soul of this country, to accept that level of centralized control over our lives. And you know, for a country that wants to be free, we can't live a life dominated by so few.
What do you think accounts for the fact that Americans in general are more likely to suspect the motives of government than of corporations?
Well, government sometimes has had a poor track record. I think one reason might be that corporations are kind of more honest about what they do. You know, Facebook's an exception, but they just say, hey, we're just profit maximizing. Politicians are often actually do very base things, but claim to be doing the serving the public purpose. I think that's part of it. I also wouldn't understate the influence of a long, essentially, a propaganda campaign to demonize government and to elevate the corporation. You know, having worked in both, I think they're just humans in the end, and they're good people and bad people in government and in corporate life. You know, it's interesting. The biggest branch of government is the military, armed forces, but actually they're not demonized. So it's not like Americans reflexively hate all government. The particular ire is turned, you know, suspiciously on those like antitrust enforcers who are supposed to control big business. You know, antitrust forces, I work with them. They're impressive people. So are people in corporations. You know, I think we need to be a little fairer in how we treat Americans, no matter what their occupation is.
Any lessons to draw from Europe, which in the present day seems more amenable, certainly, to regulation on tech giants?
You know, I think Europe is more active, more courageous in some ways, and you know, is leading the scrutiny of some of the tech giants and reminds us that no one should be above the law. I tend to take a more what we call structural or breakup-centered approach than the Europeans do, but I think that they do remind us that, as I said, you have to be concerned about all forms of power, governmental and business-related, and make sure that the country is really serving the interests of its inhabitants.
Tim Wu is a policy advocate, a professor at Columbia Law School, and a contributing opinion writer for The New York Times. His new book is The Curse of Bigness, Antitrust and the New Gilded Age. Tim, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making time for us.
And thank you for the thoughtfulness of this program. I've appreciated it.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. My personal Twitter handle is at Chris Boyd Think. We do hope you'll become regular subscribers to the Think podcast. You can do that for free using your favorite podcast app like iTunes or Stitcher or whatever it is you have. And you can find out what we have coming up on the show at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.